Chapter 3, History in Transition. In the first two chapters of this series, we presented evidence which demonstrates that God has counseled us to understand history. In past ages, God's people have been destroyed because of a lack of knowledge. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me. Seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy God, I will also forget thy children. Hosea 4, verse 6. At least part of the knowledge which will protect us as we approach these final hours of earth's history is a knowledge of the past. In the second chapter, we focused on the history which transpired during the first and second angels' messages of 1843-44. We identified this experience as prefiguring the final revival of the latter rain. We will now look at a time in history which has also been identified as necessary for our understanding. This history is directly associated with the primary focus of our study, the final six verses of Daniel 11. We read in Manuscript Releases, Volume 13, page 394, these words: "We have no time to lose. Troublous times are before us. The world is stirred with the spirit of war. Soon the scenes of trouble spoken of in the prophecies will take place." The prophecy in the 11th chapter of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. Much of the history that has taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated. In the 30th verse, a power is spoken of that shall be grieved. "For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them, and to purge, and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself, and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done." Daniel 11, 30-36. Scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. We see evidence that Satan is fast obtaining the control of human minds who have not the fear of God before them. Let all read and understand the prophecies of this book, for we are now entering upon the time of trouble spoken of. "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars for ever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Daniel 12, verses 1 through 4. End of quote. Sister White identifies the historical fulfillment of Daniel 11 as something which we should expect to see repeated as the complete fulfillment of Daniel 11 unfolds. She especially highlights Daniel 11, 30 through 36. The pioneers and Sister White understood Daniel 11 was fulfilled from verse 1 through the first phrase of verse 40, which brings us up to 1798, the time of the end. Therefore, when Sister White speaks of the complete fulfillment of Daniel 11, she is speaking of verses 40 through 45. Directing us to scenes and history which will be repeated, she isolates the history of these verses further by quoting Daniel 12, verses 1 through 4. Sister White clearly recognized Michael standing up in Daniel 12, verse 1, as being the close of probation. The complete fulfillment of verses 40 through 45 takes us from 1798 to the Battle of Armageddon. During the events described in verses 40 through 45, Michael stands up, closing his mediatorial work and human probation. See Daniel 12, verse 1. We read in Testimonies, Volume 5, pages 212 to 213, these words, "And at that time shall Michael stand up. When this time of trouble comes, every case is decided. There is no longer probation, no longer mercy for the impenitent. The seal of the living God is upon his people." End of quote. Within the time frame from 1798 to the close of probation, we should expect to see scenes similar to histories in Daniel 11, especially the history associated with Daniel 11, 30 through 36. Let us briefly review the historical fulfillment of Daniel 11, 30 through 36. The vision of Daniel 11 begins with the kingdom of Medo-Persia being defeated by Alexander the Great. In verse 4, we see Alexander's kingdom divided into four parts for his four generals. From verse 5 on, only two of his generals are mentioned. These two kingdoms were Seleucus and Ptolemy. Their interaction begins an ongoing story of the struggle for world dominion throughout the rest of Daniel 11. This power struggle is prophetically portrayed as the battle between the kings of the north and south. The south and the north are based upon the kingdom established by Alexander the Great. One important point of this story is how the scriptures identify who are the kings of the north and south. By comparing recorded history with the testimony of Daniel 11, historians and pioneers discovered that the king of the north was the kingdom which controlled the geographical area of Babylon. They discovered also that the king of the south was the kingdom which controlled the geographical area of Egypt. This principle in Daniel 11 brings together the testimony of Scripture with the record of history. This geographical key is the rule which we will apply in Daniel 11, 40 through 45, as we begin to identify who are the kings of the north and south. This historical truth is, no doubt, one of the clues which the spirit of prophecy intended to direct us to when the time came to bring this prophecy to its complete fulfillment. Through the first 13 verses, we find the ebb and flow of history described as different kingdoms rose and fell. In verse 14, we see the primary subject of all Daniel 11 identified for the first time in the vision by the phrase, "robbers of thy people." This verse states that these robbers will establish the vision. Uriah Smith addresses this phrase in verse 14 with the following observation. We read in Daniel and the Revelation, page 244, these words, "To establish the vision. The Romans, more than any other people, are the subject of Daniel's prophecy. Their first interference in the affairs of these kingdoms is here referred to as being the establishment or demonstration of the truth of the vision which predicted the existence of such a power." End of quote. From this point on, the vision portrays the history of either pagan or papal Rome. In verse 20, we find pagan Rome summons Joseph to pay taxes in Bethlehem. In verse 22, pagan Rome breaks the Prince of the Covenant by crucifying Christ. In verse 24, we see pagan Rome's time of dominion set forth within a biblical time prophecy. The last phrase of this verse sets forth 360 years as the time when pagan Rome would rule the world by the words, "even for a time." Uriah Smith concurs with other pioneers and historians on the starting and ending point for this time prophecy. We read in Daniel and the Revelation, pages 262 to 264, these words, "The battle was fought September 2nd, 31 BC, at the mouth of the Gulf of Ambracia, near the city of Actium. The world was at stake. This battle doubtless marks the beginning of the time mentioned in verse 24. As during this time, devices were to be forecast from the stronghold, or Rome, we should conclude that at the end of that period, Western supremacy would cease, or such a change would take place in the empire that that city would no longer be considered the seat of government. From 31 BC, a prophetic time, or 360 years, would bring us to AD 330. Hence, it becomes a noteworthy fact that the seat of empire was removed from Rome to Constantinople by Constantine the Great in that very year." End of quote. Pagan Rome's 360 years to rule the world had its counterpart with papal Rome's 1260-year time prophecy. More important to our study, though, is that the dominance of pagan Rome comes to its end just as the verses, especially highlighted by Sister White, begin. Verses 30 through 36 deal with the history covering the transition from pagan to papal Rome. We will find that the scenes and events within that transition period parallel the sequence of events found in verses 40 through 45. As we begin to look at verses 30 through 36, we again refer to Uriah Smith as he addresses Daniel 11, verse 29. We read in Daniel and the Revelation, pages 266 to 267, these words, "The time appointed is probably the prophetic time of verse 24, which has been previously mentioned. It closed, as already shown, in A.D. 330. The removal of the seat of empire to Constantinople was the signal for the downfall of the empire. Rome then lost its prestige. Continuing, but now dealing with verse 30. What were the ships of Chittim that came against this power, and when was this movement made? Carthage. Was a naval warfare with Carthage as a base of operations ever waged against the Roman Empire? We think of the terrible onslaught of the Vandals upon Rome under the fierce Genseric and answer easily in the affirmative. End of quote. Using Daniel 11:30-36 as an historical outline identified by the spirit of prophecy, we note that this past history was a transition time for Rome. Pagan Rome was about to leave the scene of history as the ruler of the earth, and papal Rome was about to step into the vacuum. Daniel 7 addresses this very same transition. In Daniel 7:23-24, we find that after the fourth kingdom arises, another shall arise. This is a description of the fall of pagan and the rise of papal Rome. In the prophecy of Daniel 7, we see that this fifth king shall subdue three kings as he ascends to power. Genseric, king of the Vandals, was one of those three kings. As papal Rome rises to power, three horns, or three kingdoms, had to be removed to prepare the way. This history is in itself a repetition of an earlier history found in Daniel chapter 11. For as pagan Rome came into control of the world, it first had to conquer three areas. In Daniel 8 verse 9, we see the little horn symbolizing pagan Rome waxing toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land, thus illustrating the directions of conquest taken as Rome brought the world under its control. We especially note this history for the king of the north in Daniel 11:40-45 would also subdue three entities before he took control of the world. In Daniel 11 verses 30-36, we see that pagan Rome is waning in power. When threatened by other powers in the past, Rome prevailed. Not so at this time. As Rome went out to do battle, it was grieved in its ability to prevail. At this time period, the three horns, which were waging war against pagan Rome, were also waging a theological war against Catholicism. The three horns, symbolizing the Heruli, the Goths, and the Vandals, embraced the Arian faith. During this time period, Justinian declared the Bishop of Rome to be the head of the church and the corrector of heretics in an attempt to restrain the Arian faith from dominating Catholic doctrines. Justinian's efforts to uphold Catholic doctrines against the Arian onslaught opened the door for the Catholic Church to restrict certain books which threatened their man-made doctrines. This restriction included the Bible, for they began to teach that only the church fathers could safely read it. This attack against the Bible was the indignation against the Holy Covenant and the appointment of the Bishop of Rome to the head of the church was the intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant of verse 30. Verse 31 records that arms shall stand on his part. as history and prophecy move forward in setting papal Rome on the throne of the world, we find Clovis, the King of France, dedicates his sword and country to the papacy. France became the first Catholic nation and the first of the kingdoms of Europe to renounce their pagan beliefs and embrace Catholicism, thus submitting their power to the papacy. This alliance was the ways and means to defeat the three Arian horns. Prophecy taught that these three horns would be removed before the papacy assumed authority over the world. Not only did Clovis and the other horns of Europe bring their finances and arms to bear against the three horns, they also ceased or took away their pagan resistance against Catholicism. This fact is illustrated as they take away the daily. Speaking of the daily, Sister White states in Early Writings, pages 74 and 75, these words: "Then I saw, in relation to the daily," in Daniel 8, verse 12, "that the word sacrifice was supplied by man's wisdom and does not belong to the text, and that the Lord gave the correct view of it to those who gave the judgment hour cry. When union existed before 1844, nearly all were united on the correct view of the daily, but in the confusion since 1844, other views have been embraced and darkness and confusion have followed." End of quote. The pioneers viewed the daily as symbolizing paganism. Uriah Smith describes their understanding in his book Daniel and the Revelation, pages 270 to 272. The word sacrifice should be desolation. The expression denotes a desolating power, of which the abomination of desolation is but the counterpart, and to which it succeeds in point of time. It seems clear, therefore, that the daily desolation was paganism and the abomination of desolation is the papacy. In the 9th chapter, Daniel speaks of desolations and abominations in the plural. More than one abomination, therefore, treads down the church. That is, as far as the church is concerned, both paganism and the papacy are abominations. But as distinguished from each other, the language is restricted. One is the daily desolation, and the other is preeminently the transgression or abomination of desolation. How was the daily or paganism taken away? The conversion of Clovis in A.D. 496 is said to have been the occasion of bestowing upon the French monarch the titles Most Christian Majesty and Eldest Son of the Church. Between that time and A.D. 508, the other horns of Europe were brought into subjection. From A.D. 508, the papacy was triumphant so far as paganism was concerned. When the prominent powers of Europe gave up their attachment to paganism, it was only to perpetuate its abominations in another form, for Christianity, as exhibited in the Roman Catholic Church, was and is only paganism baptized. End of quote. The history of Daniel 11, verse 31 is a description of the pagan powers of Europe coming to the aid of the papacy to set it upon the throne of the world. The removing of the daily is a description of their turning from paganism. The words "take away" carry a twofold meaning, as they not only teach a removal, but also a secondary definition conveys the idea of lifting up. When paganism was set aside by the powers of Europe through their submission to Catholicism, paganism was actually lifted up. For Catholicism is the greatest historical manifestation of paganism, though clothed in the garb of Christianity. In AD 508, the powers of Europe began to wage war against countries represented by the three horns, and by 538, the last of the three horns met defeat, and the papacy ascended to the throne of the world. Then, the abomination that maketh desolate, symbolic of the papacy, was set up. In verses 32 through 35, we see the persecution of the Dark Ages illustrated, with the final phrase of verse 35 pointing to the end of the 1260 years with the words, "even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed." This phrase takes us up to verse 40. But before Daniel gets to verse 40, verses 36 through 39 present the description of the main subject of Daniel, the papacy. "And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done." Daniel 11:36. This is clearly the papacy, and Paul paraphrases this passage in his most potent statement of the papacy. "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4. Sister White combines both Daniel's king, which does according to his will, and Paul's man of sin in describing the papacy. We read in the Great Controversy, page 50, these words: "This compromise between paganism and Christianity resulted in the development of the man of sin, foretold in prophecy as opposing and exalting himself above God. That gigantic system of false religion is a masterpiece of Satan's power, a monument of his efforts to seat himself upon the throne to rule the earth according to his will." End of quote. As we continue the study of Daniel 11:40-45, we will see a historical sequence within these verses which closely parallel the history we have just reviewed. We will set forth evidence to demonstrate that Daniel 11:40 is a description of a spiritual war between the papacy and atheism which began in 1798. We will show that France wore the crown of the King of the South in 1798, but in 1917, that crown was passed to its successor, Russia, later to be the Soviet Union. We will demonstrate that the King of the North in 1798 was the papacy, and that the papacy is still wearing that prophetic crown. Verse 40 teaches that initially in the war between the King of the South and the King of the North, the King of the North was grieved in its ability to prevail against the Southern Kingdom. In fact, the war begins with the King of the North receiving a deadly wound as his political kingdom was taken away. When writing on Daniel 11:30, Sister White points us to a time when Rome was unable to prevail against its enemy. Revelation 13 describes the papacy as the head which receives a deadly wound. The war and the grieving of the papacy is described when the king of the south would push at the king of the north in Daniel 11, verse 40. But verse 40 teaches that a change would take place. In time, the king of the north would return, and, allied with military and economic power, he would sweep away the king of the south. We will see that economic and military power were supplied to the king of the north in this war, just as Clovis came to the aid of the papacy in the past. We will see that in fulfillment of this verse, the Soviet Union, the modern-day king of the south, was swept away by the papacy, the northern king. This sweeping away was accomplished through an alliance with the United States. Not only do these recent scenes parallel the history highlighted by Sister White in Daniel 11, verses 30 and 31, but they support the testimony of Revelation 13, which identifies the United States as the beast which comes to the aid of the papacy at the end of the world. We have considered the three geographical areas which pagan Rome conquered as it came to the throne of the world. We compared it to the removal of the three horns preceding the papacy's ascension to the throne of the world, which began the Dark Ages. We will see in the next chapter that verse 40 is the first of three steps which modern Babylon takes as she returns to the throne of the world in our day. The first step was implementing the fall of the King of the South, the former Soviet Union, and this step is now past history. The second step is verse 41, when the King of the North takes spiritual control of the glorious land. The glorious land of this verse is none other than the United States, the second beast of Revelation 13. By entering into the unholy alliance with the Vatican to bring down a common enemy, the U.S. began the process of its own surrender into the hands of the papacy by denying its heritage as the champion of Protestantism. By definition, Protestantism can only mean to protest Rome. It is impossible to protest Rome when you are her ally. As Clovis came to the aid of the papacy by offering military and economic support through the acceptance of Catholicism instead of paganism, the United States not only supplied military and economic support to bring down the Soviet Union, but it began its prophetic role as apostate Protestantism, or the false prophet of Revelation 16. The fulfillment of verse 40 turns the truth of Revelation 16 into present truth as mankind is now being led to Armageddon. The third step is verse 42, in which the world, as prophetically represented by Egypt, will come into the grip of the iron fist of Rome. Then, in verse 43, the economics of the world come under the power of the King of the North. When the economics of the world come under the control of the King of the North, then the papacy has returned to the position of dominance as a geopolitical power, or in prophetic symbolism, the papacy has once again become a beast of Bible prophecy. The papacy ceased to be a beast of Bible prophecy in 1798, though it continued to be a woman of Bible prophecy. The deadly wound is identifying when the papacy ceased to rule the world as a geopolitical power, a beast. When it returns to this position, its deadly wound will have been fully healed. Verse 44 speaks of the latter rain and the persecution of God's people, while verse 45 describes the division of the world into two classes as we approach Armageddon. We will find many items of interest as we continue through the study of these verses. As we continue on in this study, we will not only defend the premises set forth here in greater detail, but we will continue to compare this sequence with the scenes and histories which Sister White specifically directs us to. Daniel 11, verses 30 through 36, is not simply a historical sequence which has been set forth as a pattern to use in order to understand Daniel 11, 40 to 45, but it is the very history of the papacy's first rise to power at the beginning of the Dark Ages. The Holy Spirit, through Sister White, directs us to the very first time the papacy came to the throne of the world as the pattern of history to compare against the final rise of the papacy to the throne of the world. What is just ahead of the church and the world is the healing of the papacy's deadly wound. The wound was the loss of the papacy's ability to exercise civil power and authority, not its cessation as a church. We read in The Great Controversy, pages 579 to 581, these words: "The influence of Rome in the countries that once acknowledged her dominion is still far from being destroyed. And prophecy foretells a restoration of her power. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast." Verse 3. The infliction of the deadly wound points to the downfall of the papacy in 1798. Paul states plainly that the man of sin will continue until the second advent. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 through 8. To the very close of time, he will carry forward the work of deception. And, let it be remembered, it is the boast of Rome that she never changes. The principles of Gregory the Seventh and Innocent the Third are still the principles of the Roman Catholic Church. And had she but the power, she would put them in practice with as much vigor now as in past centuries. Protestants little know what they are doing when they propose to accept the aid of Rome in the work of Sunday exaltation. While they are bent upon the accomplishment of their purpose, Rome is aiming to reestablish her power, to recover her lost supremacy. Let the principle once be established in the United States that the church may employ or control the power of the state, that religious observances may be enforced by secular laws, in short, that the authority of church and state is to dominate the conscience, and the triumph of Rome in this country is assured. God's word has given the warning of the impending danger. Let this be unheeded, and the Protestant world will learn what the purposes of Rome really are only when it is too late to escape the snare. She is silently growing into power. Her doctrines are exerting their influence in legislative halls, in the churches, and in the hearts of men. She is piling up her lofty and massive structures in the secret recesses of which her former persecutions will be repeated. Stealthily and unsuspectedly, she is strengthening her forces to further her own ends when the time shall come for her to strike. All that she desires is vantage ground, and this is already being given her. We shall soon see and shall feel what the purpose of the Roman element is. Whoever shall believe and obey the word of God will thereby incur reproach and persecution." End of quote.